Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The ocean covers 70% of the surface of our planet. Two-thirds lie beyond national borders. Owned by all nations and no nation simultaneously, these waters are home to some of the richest and most biodiverse environments on the planet. But they are also home to exploitation on a scale that few of us can imagine. In this vast and uncharted territory, state and non-state actors are battling to control, profit from, protect, hopefully, or obliterate the world's largest, wildest commons. In her new book, The High Seas, Greed, Power, and the Battle for the Unclaimed Ocean, today's guest, Dr. Olive Heffernan, sets sail on a journey to uncover the truth behind deeply exploitative fishing practices, investigate the devastating impact of deep-sea mining, and find out why Norway is positioning itself to begin harvesting the fish of the ocean's twilight zone. She ultimately calls for the protection and preservation of the last vestiges of wilderness on Earth. Dr. Olive Heffernan is a marine biologist turned science journalist with 20 years experience as a reporter and an editor. Her writing on ocean science and climate change has been published in many publications, including Nature, Wired, and Scientific American. Dr. Olive Heffernan was founding chief editor of Nature Climate Change and chief editor of the Marine Scientist magazine. She's also been an online news and opinion editor on climate change at Nature. She is the author of the new book, The High Seas, Greed, Power, and the Battle for the Unclaimed Ocean. Hi, Olive. Thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, hi. It's such a pleasure to join you. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. So you have a very interesting background. First of all, can you talk about why you became a marine biologist and then why you decided to become a science journalist?
Well, I grew up by the sea in Dublin, and I think, you know, it always loomed large for me. I was always really interested in the sea at the end of the road, and I had a very vivid imagination as a child and wondered what lurked beneath the waves, really. And that just took me further and further into marine science. I studied it at university, and then I did a PhD, and then I moved to the UK to become a fishery scientist working for the UK government. But a couple of years into that position, I realized that my real passion was communicating science. Mm-hmm. So I jumped ship, literally and figuratively, and I've been writing about oceans and climate change ever since. So for about 20 years now.
And how did you become so interested in the high seas? Because as you write in your book, many people just don't know that much about this vast area that covers much of the ocean.
Exactly. I think, you know, it was about 6 years ago, I was doing a lot of reporting on ocean conservation. And despite having, you know, training as a marine scientist, and despite having covered oceans and climate change for such a long time, I was doing this reporting and the penny dropped that, you know, God, it's half the planet that is ocean belonging to nobody. And the more I thought about it, the more I became interested in it. And I, you know, I wondered, what does this what does it mean for our ability to manage this space, to share its resources, and ultimately to protect it? And I think, you know, it's just one question led to another. And I thought the only way to scratch that itch actually is to write a book called The High Seas, which just came out. So, yeah, it was really born out of curiosity. I was fascinated by the fact that it was such a large part of our planet and that I just hadn't myself given it enough consideration.
Well, tell us about the high seas, because if you just kind of close your eyes and just think about the ocean, if you go to the beach and think about the ocean beyond the waves, I mean, most people will never be in that area. So tell us more about this, why it is such an incredible and critical ecosystem. You write that if you look at this vast body of water, it looks flat and motionless, but beneath the waves is a world infinitely more complex and varied than the solid ground we tread upon. So tell us more about the vast ocean.
I mean, it's so vast. You know, it's incredible to think it's actually 95% of the available habitat on Earth. Isn't that incredible to think, you know, because these waters are so deep, on average, they're 4,000 meters deep. And with that depth comes enormous volume. So if you think about any of the places that you're, you know, really familiar with on Earth, the cities or the beaches or the mountains, that's just a mere sliver of what Earth has to offer. The rest is high seas, and it is extremely varied. There's parts of the high seas that I think we have barely explored, but scientists are exploring these waters and they're finding such fascinating things. For example, there's this vast area called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, which has been earmarked for deep sea mining, and it's on average 5,000 meters deep. And scientists are discovering when they go sampling there, 90% of the animals they find there have never been seen by anyone on Earth before. They're entirely new to science. So we have incredibly deep, quiet waters like those. Then there's places like Lost City, which is, you know, this is what's known as a hydrothermal vent system. So they're much like underwater geysers. And scientists, astrobiologists believe that this particular place, which is sort of brimming with bizarre bacteria and crabs and some unusual life forms, that it might actually hold clues to the origins of life on Earth. You know, and elsewhere we've got incredible things like vast seagrass beds that are actually quite shallow in the Indian Ocean on the high seas, and elsewhere, you know, entire mountain ranges taller than the Alps underneath the sea. So there are just incredible places beyond our imagination, I think, that, you know, many of us don't fully appreciate are out there.
I absolutely love looking at the creatures that we are just seeing for the very first time, the deep sea creatures. And it is amazing to think about. But at the same time, part of me thinks, you know what, let's just leave it alone. We don't need to know who lives out there. Because if we do, who knows what's possible with world leaders or corporations going in to pillage these areas? So how do you think about that? On the one hand, it is amazing to learn about this part of the planet, but you also don't want people who can exploit it to know that there are resources out there.
That's true. I mean, I suppose I think as a former scientist, I always think knowledge is a good thing. And, you know, we can use that knowledge to say, look, 90% of what we're finding here is totally unknown. And that's evidence that we don't know enough to go and maybe exploit this resource, because we don't know what the consequences would be. We don't know, for example, if we would cause global extinctions, because it's just simply unknown to us. And there's also, I suppose, a good side to this potential knowledge, which is an opening conversation about whether we could use the genetic resources from these creatures to develop new products that would benefit all of humanity. And it would be possible to do that without harvesting them time and time again. And once you've sequenced a genome or a gene sequence from an animal, be it a sea slug or a whale, you can store that as digital information online, and that can be used to develop all manner of amazing things, from anti-aging creams to biofuels to cancer treatments.
Well, and as you write in your book, so much research is happening right now. You write, we are venturing to places we've never been before, illuminating secrets of the high seas, enabled by a new generation of ships, robots, and submersibles. We're on track to map the entire seabed in high resolution by the year 2030. And that's just incredible.
It is incredible. I mean, one of the technologies I'm most excited about is actually the sort of surveillance that we now have from satellites of the fishing fleet on the ocean. So that's only become possible in the last few years, really only in the last decade, if even that. And that is allowing organizations to track the global fishing fleet and to see what is being, you know, they can't tell exactly what's being harvested, but they can tell you know, which boats, for example, are, you know, operating in a way that maybe is suspicious. So it's allowing them to track a lot of the maybe, you know, sort of more nefarious behavior that's happening on the high seas. So I think that's really exciting, as is, of course, all of the stuff that's going on under the surface that's telling us more about what lives there and how carbon is stored in the ocean and how the ocean works more generally.
Well, so then that brings us to the question of the rules and regulations around the high seas. The high seas are defined by international law as all parts of the ocean that are not included in the exclusive economic zone, the territorial sea, or the internal waters of a country. So can you explain what this means exactly? What can you just talk about these international laws?
Absolutely. So if you think about a globe, really, you know, it's those big patches of blue. You know, in a country like the US, you have an exclusive economic zone that stretches out 200 nautical miles from shore. Everything beyond that is high seas. And it's not lawless. You know, it has this sort of reputation as a lawless frontier, a wild west of our planet. But it's actually, activities out there are managed by a sort of menagerie of bodies and rules and codes of conduct, you know, that relate to various activities like fishing or shipping or deep sea mining. But the problem is that none of them have conservation at the heart of their agenda. So they're all focused on exploitation or use. And lacking that sort of global law to conserve that space, what has happened is that we have developed an out of sight, out of mind relationship with the high seas really throughout human history. And we've plundered it and pillaged it and we've used it as a dumping ground. And that does continue to the present day. And so just to give you a sort of a big picture, like right now, only 1% of the high seas is actually protected in a meaningful sense from extractive industry. And scientists say that we need to boost that to 30% of the global ocean by 2030 if we're to maintain a healthy ocean, and that we need to manage the rest sustainably. So only 1% is protected and we're not managing the rest sustainably.
Okay, so what does that mean in practice, that only 1% of the high seas is protected?
It really means that sort of anything goes in most of the high seas because it's belonging to nobody. It has become a free-for-all. So it means that if you're a nation and that you want to go out and start a new fishery on the high seas, by and large, that's fine. Like there are management organizations that oversee fishing, but they only actually manage 5% of fish that would traverse the high seas throughout their lifetime. So 95% of fish species are unmanaged. And if you're a nation or an individual or a corporation and you want to go out and do that, there's really only 1% of the ocean, which is in Antarctica, where you can't do that. So it just means that it's open season, really, for exploitation. And that's what's happened.
Even if that number were to be higher, how would these rules and laws be enforced, given that we're talking about the high seas?
Well, I think that comes back in part to this incredible sort of revolution that we've had, really, in the ability of technology to look at the open ocean using satellites. So organizations can now use satellites to track the high seas fishing fleet. So if you're talking about fishing, that is definitely one way that it's now possible that it wouldn't have been a decade ago. In terms of other industries, I think what can happen is that there would be laws that you can't, for example, start new large-scale ventures, like maybe a seaweed farm in one of these areas. So there would be rules about what you're allowed to do and not do. But of course, you know, you're right. It is the part of our planet that is least open to scrutiny because it is so far from land. So how you enforce that, it's difficult.
Today, we're speaking with Dr. Olive Heffernan, a marine biologist turned science journalist with 20 years experience as a reporter and editor. She's out with a new book called The High Seas, Greed, Power, and the Battle for the Unclaimed Ocean. If you have any questions or comments for Dr. Olive Heffernan, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about the high seas, thinking about the ocean covering 70% of the surface of our planet. It's owned by all nations and no nation simultaneously. These waters are home to some of the richest and most biodiverse environments on the planet, but they're also home to massive exploitation. So we are going to talk with you about fishing practices, exploitative fishing practices, what's could happen with deep sea mining. We've done several shows about that. You have such interesting information about Norway positioning itself to begin harvesting the fish of the ocean's twilight zone. And you focus on a number of other issues in your book. Given that you have spent so much time on these issues, when you think about the high seas, what concerns you the most right now?
I think the emergence of entirely new industries, such as deep sea mining, that concerns me because, you know, right now, nobody has mined the deep sea anywhere. But, you know, and for a long time, there was a lot of interest, but it was nascent. But whereas now, companies are in a position, we have the technology, and they are keen to start, you know, given the green light from the regulators, they would start straight away. And there's a big portion of the ocean between Hawaii and Mexico called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone that's been earmarked for deep sea mining. It really is an unspoiled part of the ocean, and it's a very sensitive part of the ocean. So I think there is the potential to do a lot of harm. And I think, like, in a way that is actually unprecedented, because it could stir up a lot of sediment, which means that it would not only harm the creatures that live on the seafloor, but those in the water column. And really, I think the damage that would be done to the habitat itself, it is 100% irreversible. So just to explain, they want to mine these potato-sized rocks that are called manganese or polymetallic nodules. So they look like rocks, but in fact, they start their lives as like a discarded object on the seafloor, maybe something like a shark's tooth or a seashell that falls to the seafloor. And over millions of years, tiny grains of sand accrete around this node. And in those grains of sand accumulate very precious minerals and metals. So the idea is if they take those nodules, they could extract those minerals and metals, which are needed for building things like batteries for EV cars. And, you know, once you remove those nodules that have taken millions of years to form, of course, it would take millions of years for them to regenerate. So that is an irreversible harm.
And just to provide a few more facts that you shared in your book, you write that according to the World Bank Group, the world will need over 3 billion tons of minerals and metals to deploy the wind, solar, and geothermal power needed to avoid 2 degrees Celsius of warming, globally recognized as a level of climate change that is dangerous to humanity. For minerals such as lithium and cobalt, this could mean an increase in demand of 500% by 2050. You know, this is so important because, of course, there is a massive push in the United States for electric cars, for solar, for wind. It's not just the United States, but that technology has to come from somewhere. Now, some people say that we can do this without mining the deep sea. Others say we can't. You spent a lot of time traveling around the world talking to people who are working on these issues. So what did you walk away with specifically on that question?
I mean, I walked away with the feeling that we have a lot of resources left on land. And also, I do think that it's worth exploring this whole issue of urban mining. So in Europe, for example, we currently dispose of about 150 mobile phones every year. And we could actually recycle the components of those and use them. But right now, we really only recycle at best 20% of the sort of electronic waste that is disposed of every year. So I do think there are other options. And I think particularly in the next decade, I think the next decade is an important window. We could explore those options while using the resources that we have on land, which are still plentiful enough to keep us going for that period. And in the meantime, that would give us enough time to research the potential damage that deep sea mining would do. So that's what a lot of countries are calling for. They're saying, can we just have a moratorium of 10 years to figure out what the trade-offs are from doing this? And I think that that seems like a really reasonable idea.
You did point out in your book that the Institute of Sustainable Futures in a 2016 report concluded that a global transition towards 100% renewable energy could take place without deep sea mining, as the projected demand in metals could be met with land-based reserves.
That's right. And I think it's also really worth saying that, you know, some of the manufacturers themselves are working towards different technologies. For example, Tesla, I think now half of the batteries that it uses in its EV cars, they are not cobalt based. So they're looking to use other resources, other metals, so that maybe the demand wouldn't be so high for particular sources. So really within the next 10 years, maybe we might even move away from the need for those particular types of minerals or metals. And that would obviously alleviate the pressure.
But at the same time, what about what happens on land? I thought that the conversation you had with Henko de Stichter, a Dutch ocean scientist at NIAS, the Royal Netherlands Institute for Sea Research, was so interesting. You found yourself heading to sea on a Spanish research vessel, and Henko was your host. And this is what makes all of this so layered, and this is why these conversations are so important. You asked Henko, well, first of all, can you tell us about Henko? Who is he?
He is a Dutch ocean scientist who has a specialty in how sediment moves around in the ocean. And so, you know, because of that specialty, he has ended up working on the impacts of deep sea mining, as well as many other things. But that's one of his areas of interest, because he studies what these machines would do to the seafloor in terms of stirring up the sediment and how far that sediment would travel throughout the ocean, because that is one of the main potential impacts from deep sea mining. And he's a fascinating character because he grew up partly in Congo, which is one of the world's hotspots for mining, particularly for cobalt, which is one of the metals, of course, that we would source from the deep sea. So I think he has seen the very grim side of land-based mining, which, of course, you know, involves all sorts of awful practices, such as forced labor, child forced labor. And the idea, I think, for him that we could somehow move away from that is extremely appealing. And that time that I spent at sea, I was with a group of scientists led by Henko, who had partnered with a group of engineers who built a prototype mining machine. And they were testing the prototype, which eventually they will scale up to deploy in the Pacific, in the deep Pacific Ocean, to harvest these nodules that I was speaking about. And they really believed in their mission. And that was a very interesting perspective. I was very keen to join them at sea because I wanted to hear about this from a different perspective. And I think they felt that they really could develop a more sustainable industry than the one we have currently, and maybe a more ethical industry than the one we have on land.
Well, and what makes this just so complicated is Henko says, I mean, he knows what's going to happen if you mine the deep sea. He says, if you plow an untouched area on land, you change the whole ecosystem. Weeds come up and fill the void like the poppies after the war, but there's a chance of restoration. Within a decade, maybe you'll have the original vegetation back. In the ocean, if you remove the nodules, they will not be back within the next million years. So he knows the effects. But then he said, we mine on land using child labor in the Congo now. If we can mine deep sea resources in a controlled manner, then why not? So he's saying that even though he knows the effects of deep sea mining, but he also knows the effects of mining in the Congo.
Absolutely. I mean, I think for him, it is a genuine moral quandary. And I suppose that is one of the reasons I was interested in writing about it, that there are these situations that we now face, these decisions that we face that are genuinely difficult. You know, do we open new fisheries on the high seas? Do we mine the deep sea? Do we build a new shipping route or create a new shipping route through the Arctic? These are all difficult questions. And the answers are not always that straightforward. And I think it's certain that we won't all agree on all of the answers. But I do think that we should all be part of the conversation.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Olive Heffernan, a marine biologist turned science journalist who's out with an important new book, The High Seas, Greed, Power, and the Battle for the Unclaimed Ocean. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's show with Dr. Olive Heffernan, a marine biologist turned science journalist who's out with a new book, The High Seas, Greed, Power, and the Battle for the Unclaimed Ocean. Sticking with deep sea mining for a couple more minutes, you write that for the time being, no one has commercially mined the deep sea anywhere. There have been attempts by companies and nations, but the nascent industry has been beset by problems like high upfront costs, the low value of deep sea ores, and the lack of rules, which make investors wary. Despite all of this, the industry regulator, the International Seabed Authority, established by the UN, is now pushing hard to finalize a seabed mining code, which is essentially an industry rulebook. And if industry has its way, mining could begin later this year. So tell us about the International Seabed Authority.
Yeah, so the International Seabed Authority, it was set up by the UN in 1994 when it established the Law of the Sea, which is essentially like a constitution for the global ocean. And it was given this strangely conflicting mandate. So, you know, it has two roles, really. It's supposed to promote and facilitate mining of the deep sea, but it's also supposed to protect the deep sea from harm. So, you know, some conservationists would say that it's been hopelessly conflicted from the outset. And I think the reasons that it was given that mandate, they were good reasons, actually. You know, one of the reasons was that it was supposed to help facilitate mining that was commercial and to help share the profits of that for all of humanity. Because the deep seabed is owned by everyone, it is the common heritage of humankind, we're all supposed to profit from deep sea mining in theory. And that was the ISA's mandate. So really, it's been trying to finalize this rule book of how mining would operate and how any of this, how it would share those profits and allow mining to take place and protect the seabed. It's been trying to figure that out for a long time, and it's a very complicated process.
The BBC reported in January that Norway has become the first country in the world to move forward with deep sea mining. It'll accelerate the hunt for the precious metals that you talked about before the break. Can you talk more about this, and what else should we know about where we are right now? Who you write about some of the other countries that are and companies. You actually have an interview with the head of a company who wants to mine the deep sea. But first off, what are your thoughts about Norway becoming the first country to move forward with this?
I mean, it's so surprising in a way, because just to give you some context about Norway, in 2018, Norway set up an initiative called the High Level Panel for a Sustainable Ocean Economy. And it was really this unprecedented effort to garner knowledge about the ocean. And it made this incredible commitment that by 2025, it would manage its entire waters sustainably. So 100% sustainable management of its waters by 2025. And it persuaded lots of other nations, I think 17 in total, including the US, came on board to make the same pledge. And this initiative was informed by 250 global experts who spent about 3 years of their time writing reports to inform Norway what that would actually mean in practice. And for Norway, they had two chief recommendations. One was you cannot mine the deep sea within your own coastal waters or your extended, you know, exclusive economic zone. And you absolutely can't, you can't drill for more oil and gas. And that is both of the things they have done. So, you know, they took all of this advice, and then they have sort of initiated policies that I suppose have, you know, flown in the face of the scientific advice they were given. So I think it shocked a lot of people. I think people were really surprised by this. But the situation that Norway has is that, you know, it's earned a lot of money from oil and gas exploration in the past, and it is looking to diversify its economy. So I think that's why it's interested in deep sea mining. It's worth saying that the World Wildlife Fund for Nature in Norway is now taking a legal case against the government because of this decision. So it'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
And given that this all is happening right now, that this could begin by the end of the year, what can people do about this?
I mean, as a starting point, I don't think it will start by the end of this year, perhaps next year. You know, I think companies might be a bit wary of starting before the regulations have been finalized, and the mining code has not yet been finalized by the International Seabed Authority. But there is a growing body of experts and companies, even, you know, companies like Samsung and Google and Renault, and also individual nations that have spoken out and said we would really prefer a moratorium for 10 years before this proceeds. So I think, you know, people who are concerned can lend support to that movement.
Well, I would encourage listeners, I'll see if this is on our resources, I'll add this. National Geographic had a piece last week, "These deep sea animals are new to science and already at risk." And it's just photos of these, I mean, Olive, you've seen them, that these amazing creatures that look like they're out of a science fiction children's book. I mean, it's just, they're so amazing to look at, and to think that we share the planet with these incredible creatures who live in the deep sea. They never see the light of day.
They are incredible. I was lucky enough last year to visit London's Natural History Museum. So one of the chief scientists who was involved in these expeditions to survey the Clarion-Clipperton Zone and to bring back these creatures from the deep abyss, he is stationed at London's Natural History Museum, and I had a chance to visit him and to see lots of these wonderful creatures, unfortunately preserved in jars, but I still managed to get a good sense of just how varied and unique and wonderful they are. I think my favorite is one called the gummy squirrel, which actually looks like a cross between a shoe and a banana. I mean, I've really never seen anything like this before. It's very strange. And it's a type of sea cucumber that lives, you know, 5 kilometers down. It's just incredible. It's mind blowing.
Really amazing. Yeah, if you have time, really, just search for deep sea creatures and spend some time looking at these, like the gummy squirrel. It's so amazing. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. Just a comment and a question to your guest. One is, it's puzzled me why it's taken so long for companies or governments around the world to put the kind of research into developing alternative sources of energy, and including battery storage. I'm glad to hear that Tesla is doing this, but it just seems to me that that would be an incredibly important thing to do, is to find other ways to store energy and not have to rely on these minerals. The second part of this is a question to your guest. We're running out of time to change these things, and I'm wondering why there hasn't been a serious conversation universally, and this is both for the oceans and for the atmosphere, the environment, atmospheric environment. Why there hasn't, I mean, because COP is not doing it. So why there hasn't been a concerted effort universally to try and sit down and really hammer out what needs to be done to try and change this? And I'm sure that one of the answers is there's just too much money, corporate, profits to be made other than doing this. But without that kind of a conversation where people are going to say, hey, look, we're stuck. We've got a real serious problem. Let's have a serious conversation and get to some serious results. Otherwise, we're going to be cooked.
Thank you, Greg. Can I answer that?
Please.
Well, I'm so glad you actually asked that question, Greg, because there has been this incredible effort, which I document in the last chapter of the book. So for 20 years, conservationists were trying to push through a global law to protect the high seas. And they did manage to do that last March at the UN, a high seas treaty. And I think it is the most important piece of ocean legislation really ever passed, because it gives countries the ability to create large marine protected areas on the high seas. There was no legal way of doing that before now. Of course, you know, this is a global law and it needs to be transposed into national legislation. And that process will probably take somewhere between 4 to 8 years. And you're right, we are running out of time. But I think it's very important that that happened. I think that's a game changer, actually. If they could really make it happen in practice on the ocean, it would be just a rewriting of the rules for the high seas. I think there's also other things that are happening. Like just 2 weeks ago, there was a ruling by the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea to say that greenhouse gases are a marine pollutant. I mean, it sounds so obvious, but in fact, they hadn't been classified as a marine pollutant until now. And there was a unanimous verdict on this, and it puts the onus back on industry that uses the high seas and also on nations to try to enact change to prevent them polluting with these greenhouse gases. So I think, you know, it seems sometimes more of a multi-generational pivot towards change rather than the sort of, I think, tipping point that we all want to see, or the kind of, you know, huge upheaval. But we are getting there slowly but surely.
Well, and going back to deep sea mining, given that this is moving as we speak, that companies and countries are hoping to do this, tell us more about what else people can do. I mean, as you write, the International Seabed Authority governing deep sea mining is out there. It's working. It's meeting right now. But you also say part of its mandate is to facilitate exploitation. So how effective is this body, and how are the decisions influenced by the member states, by corporate influence?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of individuals wanting to influence the ISA, it is made up of member states. So I suppose, you know, lobbying at a national level for your representatives to go to the ISA with support for the moratorium is how you as an individual can influence that process. Or you can support the nonprofits. There's a lot of civil society that turns up at those meetings, nonprofits that are ocean focused, that are calling for more accountability and transparency, because that has been one of the criticisms of ISA, that, you know, some of the meetings happen behind closed doors, or that the documentation isn't always made as readily available as it should be. But, you know, the ISA, I think that the plan really at the beginning was that the ISA would set up a sort of a commercial arm called the Enterprise. And for every plot of the deep sea that was assigned as a mining area. Half of it would be given to a commercial company that had partnered with a state, a sponsoring state, and the other half would be set aside for the enterprise. And the enterprise would mine that area commercially, and the profits of that mining would be shared with the developing world. So that was the plan. But when you look at the actual numbers, it doesn't look like it would generate much profit. I mean, there was a 2019 study which, you know, granted was preliminary, but it suggested that every man, woman and child in the world would get about $2.50 from this. Hmm. So, you know, as a trade-off, it's not very good.
Right. Today we're speaking with Dr. Olive Heffernan, a marine biologist turned science journalist. She's out with a new book, The High Seas, Greed, Power and the Battle for the Unclaimed Ocean. Let's now talk about a disturbing part of your book, about crime on the high seas. I mean, again, this is incredible to think about. So as you write, one in every five fish that humans eat is caught illegally. One in every five fish. So we'll talk about that. But first, there's all of these offenses, as you write, ranging from forgery, tax evasion, and money laundering, to slavery, drug running, and human trafficking. And this is all happening on the high seas. You write that the big players usually transit through international waters, often going dark, so they switch off the usual modes of communication that could be used to locate them, even when they're far from land. And on the rare occasion these people are caught, their crimes are seldom punished, as no one owns the high seas. So tell us more about this. There's so many crimes that you're talking about here. I mean, the most horrific, obviously, are slavery and human trafficking.
That's right. I mean, I think that, so let me start with the sort of fish crimes. I think, you know, okay, it's worth saying, like, there are fewer rules and there's less enforcement of rules with distance from land, and people just take advantage of that. So if we look at fishing, some of the worst transgressions happen on the high seas. You know, basically the depletion of inshore fisheries has made a frontier of the offshore ocean. And so now fishers are more likely to go further afield in search of ever dwindling resources. And reaching those fishing grounds requires large vessels and plentiful fuel and supplies. And the costs are really high. And yet the profits are really low in this industry. It's hard to make a profit. So fishers are tempted to use unscrupulous means to boost their profits. You know, that might be misreporting the type or the size of the catch, or targeting waters where there's no quota, or poaching for marine reserves. And that kind of pirate fishing costs the global economy about $50 billion a year in lost taxes. But I think what few people understand is that it's also a convergence crime. You know, people who are likely to maybe fill their holes with sharks maybe think less of using slaves at sea. And it's also a way of boosting their profits. So typically what happens is that they recruit these, you know, young, uneducated men from poor countries, often in Indonesia. And, you know, they don't know that they're going to be kept as slaves at sea, but they end up debt bonded and forced to work sometimes, you know, 22 hours a day. It's, the conditions are absolutely grueling, and some of the stories are just beyond horrific. You know, at any one point in time, about 20% of the high seas fishing fleet is off the radar. So they've gone dark. They've switched off their communications transponders, which would allow them to be detected. And presumably they are involved in some sort of nefarious activities, whether it's, you know, human slavery or human trafficking, drug running, the whole lot of it, really.
A private investigator, Tim McInnell, told you, working with organized crime and homicide did not prepare me for what I saw in the fishing industry. You have so many examples. Just one, a 2014 investigation by the AP revealed that hundreds of young, poor, uneducated men had been trafficked from Myanmar, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand, and were being held often for years as slaves in small cages in a tiny hamlet called Benjina on Indonesia's Aru Islands. They were tortured, beaten, and once unshackled, forced to work on vessels fishing the high seas for up to 24 hours a day for a company called Pusaka Benjina Resources. The company had a mass graveyard for those who did not survive. I mean, this is horrific.
Absolutely horrific. And I think that, yeah, few people probably understand the scale of that. It's interesting as well to think, you know, just who is this actually benefiting? If you think about the distant water fishing fleet, most of it is comprised of Chinese vessels. So the Chinese distant water fishing fleet, it outsizes the US distant water fishing fleet at least 10 times. So it's hard to actually say how many vessels there are that are Chinese. They say 3,000. An independent analysis said closer to 17,000. But the other nations that are active in fishing the high seas are Taiwan, Korea, Japan, and Spain. And it's interesting that actually a lot of these fisheries, like this activity, is really unprofitable, and it's buoyed up by government subsidies. So there was an analysis a few years ago that showed that basically 54% of these individual high seas fishing trips would be completely unprofitable if they weren't buoyed up by government subsidies. And when you think about, does this contribute to global food supply? Actually, only 2.5% of the fish that is consumed globally on an annual basis comes from the high seas. So my point is, this really isn't benefiting very many people at all. And it's gruesome. You know, it's a horrible source of human rights abuses, and it's also decimating wild stocks. So we're at a position now, I mean, you mentioned one in five fish that we eat being, you know, harvested illegally, but it's also the case that a third of global fish stocks are overexploited. Between about 20 to 25% of marine species are at risk of extinction. You know, the amount of bycatch associated with high seas fisheries is huge. But between about 60,000 and 100,000 seabirds are caught accidentally in fishing nets every year. And a lot of that happens on the high seas.
Well, given what you just laid out, that this is not profitable, why would a country like China spend so much on resources on fishing the high seas?
Like, you can only think that it's geopolitical in some way. I have to wonder why they would maintain such a sizable high seas fishing fleet when, you know, it's not really that profitable. It needs to be subsidized, and it really contributes very little to food supply. It's bizarre. I mean, there have been academics who have argued that we should close the high seas to fishing. And in fact, all the evidence suggests that if we did that, inshore fisheries would rebound. You know, it might not stop the absolute amount of fishing, but it would make it more fairly distributed. So it would be good for local economies. And when you think about the high seas as our largest global commons, we should all be benefiting from it, which clearly isn't the case right now.
For people who don't want to be connected to these industries and these practices, I mean, as you say, policy changes are what's needed. But for people who do not want to be eating fish that are caught illegally, caught by people who are enslaved, I mean, we don't have time to talk about this, but you even talk about how labels are very misleading. You know, protected, quote, areas can be the most exploited. So what can people do who don't want to be eating fish that are caught this way?
I mean, I think the best thing you can do is to look at the certification bodies. In the UK, it's the Marine Stewardship Council, and they award certification to fisheries that are deemed to be sustainable. I mean, of course, there's a lot of academic arguments about whether that's done to the extent that it should be and whether there's enough scrutiny, but that is probably your best starting point. Or, you know, eat something that you absolutely know has been caught locally. That's probably your best bet.
Right. And the best way to go about that, I mean, that's the problem. You have in your book, you write about how fish are caught one place and then sent to another country for processing and sent to another country. I mean, it's head spinning. It's very hard to really follow the path about, you know, where did this fish come from and how was it caught?
Absolutely. And when you think about fish on the high seas, like tuna, for example, a lot of them are what are called transboundary stocks. So, you know, they're mobile creatures, of course, and it's not like they spend their entire lives on the high seas. You know, they're moving in and out of coastal waters and into nations' exclusive economic zones. So, you know, you wouldn't actually know probably whether it's been caught on the high seas or, you know, within an EEZ. I think that, you know, there are good rules of thumb about maybe like looking at things that are endangered or under, you know, threatened and avoiding those species. But if you're really unsure about that, there's a good fish guide that is produced in the US. And I think that that is probably, you know, the most educated guess that you can have as to what you should eat and feel, you know, a sense of peace of mind about it.
Olive, we have just a couple minutes left. You end the book with a chapter called Hope for the High Seas. And you say that you imagined you'd finish this book with an uplifting vision of the future, describing how the high seas will look decades from now, managed properly. I mean, let's hope this happens. You write, in this vision, there are sprawling marine sanctuaries filled with an abundance of animals. They are placed strategically, covering hundreds of thousands of square miles of our most precious places offshore. I mean, people are working to get there. So what are your thoughts? What are you walking away with after doing all of this research?
Yes, I mean, I did really want to end the book on a positive note. And I would say I'm trying to work on that to feel more positive about it. I think the High Seas Treaty was a major win. But I also think, you know, when you look at what happens out on the high seas and just the fact that nations and corporations and people find loopholes, I find that quite dispiriting. And the fact that, you know, entire industries get a free pass on the rules sometimes because they benefit national economies. I think a good example is, you know, this issue of space waste being dumped in the Pacific Ocean. You'd never think that that was, you know, the world's largest spacecraft cemetery. And one of the things about the treaty that is being agreed is that it can regulate against new emerging activities, but not things that are already in process. So it probably has limited power to push back against deep sea mining, for example, or to, you know, stop the high seas fishing that's already happening out there. It has to work around the existing activities. And I suppose my worry is just that we're at this moment in time where, you know, our footprint is growing on the global ocean. Right now we have 66%.
And we have 10 seconds left.
Sorry?
We have 10 seconds left. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. So yes, trying to feel more hopeful. I'm working on it.
Yes, we all are.
Yes,
really.
Working on it. That's
yes.
It. Yeah.
It's a never ending process. Dr. Olive Heffernan is the author of The High Seas, Greed, Power, and the Battle for the Unclaimed Ocean. Thank you so much for your work. We'd love to have you back.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.